Let's go ahead and get started. Before you do that, we may just do some introductions. First of all, you know, I want to welcome all of you to this special meeting. These police policies are pretty important business. And, you know, we take very seriously this work of trying to go through them with maybe not a fine-tooth comb, but a comb with a lot of teeth to try to figure out, you know, what updates or remedies can be made, if any need to be made. And I think all of you are here tonight because you have some idea about what some of these policies are meant to look like. And so, you know, thank you for that. Thank you for coming out tonight. Please don't feel weird about going back there and getting more Mexican food. I don't think that's going to offend anybody. And I'm looking forward to some pretty productive conversation. I'll introduce myself first, and then, you know, since we're in a little more of an informal session, we're not on the dais. I don't know that it has to be, you know, members first and then the public, you know. I'll go first, and then we'll loop around, and then we'll go back there, if that's all right. So I'm Reese Ellis. I'm the current chairperson of CPRP. And Anthony?
Yeah, I'm Anthony Wellroth. I'm vice president of Race Matters Friends.
I'm Renee Carter. I'm president of Race Matters Friends.
Chris Jones, speak fairly frequently on behalf of Hold Como Accountable.
Brandon Barnes, Citizens Police Review Board member.
Doug Hunt, Citizens Police Review Board member.
Jamie Thornberry, board member.
Cheryl Miller, Human Rights Liaison to the Citizens Police Review Board and vice chair currently.
Xavier Scruggs, board member.
Stephanie Coleman, board member.
Julie Ray, Columbia Police Department liaison.
Adam Ward, Columbia Police Department Policy and Accreditation Manager.
Rose Wilhelmeyer,
Waterburn, Staff Liaison.
Hello, I'm Ava
Horn
from the Columbia, Missouri.
I'm Zoe Owen,
also from Columbia, Missouri.
And Bettman from Columbia, Missouri.
Emily O'Dell. I live in Columbia.
Rebecca Shaw, citizen.
Nick Foster, City Council.
Tony Messina, Columbia Police.
You got to be Thompson, City of Columbia.
Betsy Peters, City of Columbia.
CRT, Cambridge, City 13.
Mitchell Kavinsky, ABC 17.
Well, now, welcome.
I think we're all familiar with each other. Okay. So, would you like to get started on our review? We've got Officer Ward.
Sure.
Right, Dave.
So, I don't have any formal presentation. I mean, I can just pull up our policies. They're all public documents.
Yes.
You guys can find them electronically on our city website, or if you guys have hard copies, that's just fine too.
I think they were hyperlinked into that agenda.
Oh,
you
could have,
yeah, you could have just pushed, yeah, right there.
Well, here we go.
Fancy.
You're welcome.
That's the teacher.
Yeah. I'm like, come on, push the button.
Is that
That's better.
Size okay?
Mm-hmm.
So. That's fine.
I can scroll down for anybody that wants to keep going through.
So I'm seeing here the last revision date is January 2021.
Yes.
So you happen to know, I think you've said that there is still a, you know, process ongoing to update these policies. Is that still the case? Has that been going on since 21, or when did that start?
As far as I know, we've been generally reviewing policy yearly, some maybe not so extensively. We'll try to review them as often as possible just to keep them up to date, you know, following best practices.
Okay. So for some of this language that exists, you know, I guess I wonder, was there a model you all were following, or do you happen to know the history on some of this, like specifically kind of the big blurb in 300.2 where it kind of sets out, you know, the city of Columbia's vision of, you know, this policy here.
So here at the bottom, and a lot of, as far as I know, we've kind of gotten away from electrical stuff. But for a while there, we did use a lot of electrical for our policies.
And for the layman, Lexipol is?
It's a policy writing agency. It's, from what I understand, it's very generic policies that, you know, kind of cover the broad things. So
basically, the city had a contract with Lexipol, or a vendor who provided a license to use a Lexipol product. And what the police did is they would look at the suggested policy from Lexipol, and it would have commentary. And some places would say you can choose this or this. And then they would develop their policy from that. And from that point, it went through the police department's attorney for their review to make sure, because Lexipol is a national company, to tailor it to Missouri. And that was when they were originally put into place, but then they were edited from there. And somebody told me that maybe we don't have a license with Lexipol anymore, a contract with them, but I don't know that.
I don't.
So.
Yeah, it looks like it might have ended in 2021. Does that sound about right?
It could have. I mean, that would be the guy that did that before. He would probably be much better than I would. As far as I know, we're not using Lexipol. I don't have contact with them that's been giving me any sort of information. So
that
would be an example of something that would
provide. And so who would the vendor be now, I guess, for
we don't have any vendors that we're with as far as policy, right? It's work in house and feedback and best practices, state law, federal law, all that kind of stuff that would be referenceable, right?
So are you guys currently working on the policy 300, or are you working through everything? I mean, are you?
Yeah.
Yes, okay.
Yes, there's a lot it's a lot of projects going on at once.
It's really difficult when you try to tweak, adjust, update a policy. It tends to ripple out into multiple policies.
Areas.
And so then you have to see if you have to fix that one first before you can go back and clean it all up, or if you can go through and hit that one on the back end.
Yeah.
But they do tend to ripple out into other ones. So.
Yes.
Would you explain Kalia?
Yeah, so. Is anybody in here familiar with CALEA?
With what?
CALEA. So what that is, it's an accreditation agency. The acronym CALEA, the Commission for Accreditation on Law Enforcement Agencies. They started back in 79 as just a credentialing agency for law enforcement agencies. Four different agencies, IACP, NOBLE, NSA, and PERF, kind of came together and developed a list of standards that they put out for law enforcement agencies to kind of follow and write their policies, procedures, and any sort of documents that the kind of government agency. And provided that agency is following those standards and proving that they follow those standards, they would be accredited by CALEA. And that's kind of how we're forming our policies, and the end goal with this is to be accredited by CALEA.
So I kind of want to look at a specific point in here, 300.6.5, which is the chokehold policy, page 4, because I'm passingly familiar with the first standard, certainly not as familiar as others. I'm not entirely sure where they fall on this, but I know that other cities have, you know, in opinion on this, but I noticed in our policy, we do allow choke holds in a in an unless situation as opposed to a complete prohibition, which you know, exists in, I want to say, DC and a couple of other places. And so, you know, I was wondering if you're familiar with the discussions that went on around that, of why, you know, instead of a complete prohibition on that kind of, you know, restraint, we just we have an extremely limiting kind of language as opposed to complete prohibition.
Both, I'm sorry, can you repeat
so,
the question?
So, like in a lot of cities, the choke holds are completely banned, but
sure.
In our language, it says, you know, choke, strangle, or similar holds with which restrict the person's ability to breathe are prohibited unless, which is not a complete prohibition.
Sure.
So I was wondering if you were familiar with the conversations that happened about why we ended up with an unless as opposed to a total ban.
Yeah, I did see some presentations, most memorably by former chief, Jeff Jones. That's the one I remember the most. I know there was probably a lot more discussion back and forth on that, but that's,
so what was his policy on it? Why?
We would be able to use a chokehold in the situation of deadly force. When deadly force is authorized, we would be able to use a chokehold to address that situation.
What does it mean, like that authorization that comes from?
So any incident where we'd be allowed to use deadly force, shooting somebody, for example, we could use a chokehold if it was also there and we felt like it was a deadly force incident.
Like your life is threatened?
Yes. My life, the life of somebody else, yes.
Do you happen to know whether or not we would need to get rid of that language to be accredited?
No. So the standard basically says if you have the ability to do that, what are those guidelines? So let me find this.
I know that the Department of Justice has this kind of, or the federal government has this kind of language about it's okay unless, but you know, the states and the cities vary on that. And I'm not entirely sure what our state law is. I don't know exactly when, because is there some way we can find out when each of these pieces made their way into the code, you know, to see, you know, because it says the different revision dates. So I do kind of wonder, is that policy from when, you know, Brian Williams or whoever updated the state statute to ban chokeholds, or does it predate that? Or do you know if there's a way to find out, you know, when each of these things were last?
Yeah, I could pull up the archive documents. If you have specific questions about when things were at, I can compare the drafts and all that.
If that's not putting you on the spot, but, you know, of course you can provide that to me later. But I am curious when we got the chokehold language.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
The RSMO states, like for the state, says a law enforcement officer shall not knowingly use a respiratory chokehold unless the use is in defense of an officer or another from serious physical injury or death.
So they also use unless in the state. But there would be not, and you know, I'm not a lawyer, but from my understanding that you know, if anyone else has a different interpretation, that there's nothing in that would prevent us from having something more restrictive than state law on that piece.
Adam, I had a far more generic question that we can maybe go back to Reese, not about a particular policy, but about the situation that we're in on the Citizens Police Review Board, because we're often reviewing interactions and making recommendations about a change in policies and procedures. And as I've told Rose and Julie occasionally, I hope we're not just making things more complicated. It's such a piecemeal document in some ways. And so help me understand. We will work hard on wording of a resolution that we're forwarding, but I'm trying to get a clear picture of what happens with it after that, because we're not necessarily saying it needs to be changed in this section I think you could end up with a crazy quilt of a document if things keep getting on and on. So what's the process by which the sense of a resolution passed by us, endorsed by other people in the police department, let's say, gets worked in? Is there a time when you or somebody looks and says, well, really what we need to do is change this and this to get that effect with somewhat different words, and then can we get a chance to see what those changes look like, you know, when they actually get implemented?
So for this particular policy, is that?
Well, any number of policies. That's why I said it's a generic question about the process by which citizens can give input that leads to a change in the policy.
We're always able to take suggestions regarding policy revisions. Now, as far as I know, there's not a formal process for citizens to, you know, come to us and say, hey, I'd like to change this policy to reflect these things. I know these are like a topic of discussion for this particular meeting, but we don't have like a formal process where
like public comment period or
as far as I know, you know, the only thing I know about is these types of meetings where a particular policy is kind of up for debate, or there's something, some questions people have about it and they want to review it. That's as far as I know.
Why don't you explain the full internal process of how you write or change policy?
So our internal process for any policy change is if somebody internally thinks that there's some things that need to change with the policy, they will submit those revisions to their chain of command, so their sergeant, lieutenant, their assistant chief in that bureau. Once that happens, they pass it along to the accreditation manager, who then reviews it to ensure compliance with the CALEA standards. Once that happens, we would pass it along to our city legal representative with the police department to ensure that it's legally sound. Then that goes to our diversity, equity, and inclusion officer, who's at the police department for his review. And then it would go through our chief of police and possibly a designated assistant chief. That's kind of to the chief at that point. Once the chief signs off on the policy at the police department, it then goes to the city HR director, and then from there it goes to the city manager for his signature, review approval, back to us, and then we submit the document and disseminate it to our people and say, hey, this is the new policy, and they review, they sign it. If there's any sort of training component or exam that they have to complete for that document, we do that too at that time.
So then there's no input from citizens in any of these policies, is what I'm hearing.
Right.
Correct.
Correct. At this point, yes.
So is there a notice, I mean, after the policy has been implemented, is there a notice that you guys give out there so that the citizens know that there's been a policy change?
Historically, I'm not aware of any, unless it's something that has been addressed in a meeting like this.
Well, That would be something I'd like to request, but I think that we might have to put together something to do that, as opposed to just me as a person.
At one point years ago, there were public meetings once the policy was written internally for the community to come if they liked, and they could review it and make any suggestions and all that before it went over to the city, as far as I know. But that stopped several years ago. I can't tell you exactly when or who went.
It was right after, it was right about the time of the pandemic, because I went to some of those meetings, and then when the pandemic hit, a lot of things changed, and they, not just with the city, but in life, just didn't come back, you know, so that's when I remember it ending.
So during those meetings, were you guys allowed to give input then, or offer changes?
Yeah, and ask questions.
Okay.
So I think that was a good, I felt like that was a good practice, because, you know, you read a policy and you don't know what for, you know, what kind of thought went into each piece and why it's significant, or if you don't agree with it, you know, legally why they could put it in there. So.
How often were those meetings?
I want to say they were quarterly.
Wow.
I only got to go to a couple of them because I was just getting really involved, and then pandemic hit and no one met.
I have, we had an interesting discussion. Not everybody was in the room in closed session, but we had an interesting discussion around the language of de-escalation. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I think there is a large chasm of definition that maybe the police uses for de-escalation versus what the citizen might think of de-escalation. And the language and the definition, because again, it may include the use of such techniques as command presence, whatever that means, advisements, warnings, verbal persuasion, and tactical repositioning.
He's on 300.3.
On the second page.
Yeah,
for everybody
on page two.
Yeah, definition.
So there when reviewing and auditing these files that we have, and we look and see, we're like, oh, well, or, you know, something will come on the news, we'll watch, and you'll say, well, they should de-escalate. But I think the language here of de-escalation, I think what's happening that we're seeing is actually de-escalation in this policy language, but not necessarily what a citizen might think of as de-escalation. What does command presence mean? What are advisements? What is tactical repositioning? Could a de-escalation be, I'm making myself very large. I'm a big guy, right? But that could be intimidating to some people. I make myself large. I give verbal commands, and I'm sure I'm yelling obscenities or something. And then am I reaching for my weapon? That seems to me that that's the definition of police's de-escalation. But to me, that's an escalation.
Right. Yeah. Right.
I'm threatened now.
Mm-hmm.
So, mm-hmm. I don't know if I have a question or not, but I'm just saying around that language, I can see how the public could be like, no, you're not de-escalating, you're escalating.
Well,
and could there be reviews of this? I mean, I'm not trying to make a joke. All right, I don't want to be in that position either. However, we are citizens here,
right?
And we're watching you and reviewing you and want all these good judgments to happen. But it seems to me that the language and the policy and, I mean, the ethos of the police department is escalation from citizens.
Mm-hmm. And possibly PERF also. Things that I read in PERF about de-escalation, that wouldn't be de-escalation, I don't believe, in their eyes. Where it says de-escalation, the things that you read off wouldn't be considered de-escalation. Not using, you know, their focus on using communication and distance and other techniques to help someone calm down, rather than this seems like it's more like I'm going to de-escalate by taking control,
stopping the situation.
Yeah,
right.
What?
Yeah, right. Rather than actually,
I mean,
what the definition of de-escalation.
I think that at the very least there's some room for a lot of those terms to be elaborated on a little more. Like the part of the policy it appears in is 300.3 definitions. The point of this is to clarify terms that are used in the policy, but then it just kind of brings up new terms that are equally as vague as any of the terms they're originally trying to define. So I mean, at a certain point you could do that for forever and say, you know, we need to define each new term we introduce, but I just feel like there are a couple there, like tactical repositioning, command presence, things that, like, if you're not inside the police department command infrastructure, you're probably not going to have any idea what that means. Granted, this is, I think this document needs to serve both as an internal policy document, but also something that an average citizen could read and walk away with an understanding of.
Well, and PERF also states that, so it says tactical reposition, but PERF actually states de-escalation needs to include falling back to go back. You don't need to hold your ground. It very specifically states not holding your ground. So if PERF is considered best practices, and we've got a very good example of use of force this past January where the police department decided not to fall back, not, but instead held their ground, and the guy ended up dying. So we need to put in there that it does need to include not holding your ground, if that is PERF's definition of best practices.
I mean, I think all is great, but it doesn't sound like, I'm hopeful that this input can be, like something can be done with it, but I'm not hearing
that. I'm sorry, what did you say?
I don't know, I'm talking in the wind, I guess.
No,
we're listening to you.
What I'm saying is, like, this is all great, we can come up with all these things, we can say, hey, de-escalation should have this language and PERF and COLI and all these things, but is the department willing to listen and maybe make some policy changes? Maybe that's an emotional ask, but to me,
I think that's our hope. I mean, I think that's why we all came here, is that they will hear us and may, you know, hopefully with when the new chief comes, and you guys are working on policy now anyway, so I think it's a good time.
I mean, I think that's what the citizens are going to want, the new
yeah.
police chief. I mean, yeah, we heard it last night.
Yeah.
Well, we hear it every.
Yeah, night. They appear at every meeting, too.
So I guess I'm
got kinda, someone in the back.
Oh, yeah, please. Sorry, Rebecca.
I just, to nitpick language, if that really, and I feel like that is what we're looking at. But in 3.2, that's the first time that de-escalation is mentioned in this policy. And it says, if possible. It doesn't say this should be your first step.
Right, right. It should
and
be.
And I think that that's a huge misstep in this. I think your very first action should be to try to de-escalate everything and try to give space and time to the situation, because with more space and time, everybody is going to react mm-hmm. in a better way. Especially if you have someone in crisis or someone under stress. The more time and distance you put between that person and the officer, it's safer, I think, for each individual.
Well, and that holds true in all areas, because I was trained in, wasn't called de-escalation, but it was, you know, trying to prevent crisis, right? And the first thing isn't that you run in on a person. The first thing is you step back, you know, you keep your distance, you lower your voice, you don't do things that make that person feel threatened, like they need to respond. Is a lot of times that person will calm down on their own, and then you can have a discussion with them afterwards. And I think there's a lot of situations that we're seeing with the police that are the same, is that retraining them of how they approach people can make a huge difference in the outcome.
Well, here it says they have annual training in de-escalation.
But well, only 1 hour.
But their definition of de-escalation isn't de-escalation.
Right. I mean, they're training on escalation. However, I didn't allow you to answer the question, though, of, at least could you answer, please, what is command presence, and then also what is tactical repositioning? I've sort of tried to answer the question for you, and I shouldn't have done that.
No, that's fine. I'll also say, and I'll answer your question, part of my goal with this policy thing, I'm also trying to make things a little bit more clear, because there are some things in there that even our own officers don't understand. Let's be straight up with it.
Right.
So I want to make things as clear as we possibly can for us, for everybody that's reading it. Now to answer your question about command presence, I mean, I think it can mean a couple different things depending on how you interpret it, right? It could mean making yourself louder, more vocal, but it could also mean just being strong, stoic, all that kind of thing. It just depends on who's interpreting that and who is using it in that situation. Tactical repositioning could mean falling back, could mean getting closer, could mean taking a different position depending on where a perceived threat is. So honestly, it's there's really, in my opinion, reading that, no hard and fast definition to what command presence would be. Just what is that officer thinking that command presence is at that time? Do I need to make myself louder? Do I need to just stand there and look a certain way to address the situation? So I know it's not the maybe the best answer, but I think, like I said, you can interpret it in different ways.
I think it's actually a great answer because you said it. You know, sometimes our officers don't know. And, well, they don't know the definition. It's vague. It could be sure. This. It could be that. And again, your annual training on de-escalation is, I mean, are they trained on both this and that? Or is it one thing that they've got to do? Or, I mean, I'm sure it's to the, whatever the situation might be, right? They've got to do something different.
Yeah.
But it doesn't, well, but it could be they fall back and all that stuff too. Just doesn't seem that way, but that's you know, just an opinion.
Sure.
So, as this police policy has kind of developed over the years, because now that we're talking about this, it is a question of mine. Is this the most well-defined that these terms have been, or has it gotten more vague over the years to try to give officers a little more, you know, subjectivity in their dealings with people? Or is this the most definitions that we've had? I know you haven't worked on them since the beginning of time, of course, but.
I can't speak to what the previous accreditation manager did and the definitions he was looking at when he wrote those. I would assume that he was going off best practices and those types of things. I'm trying to go through these definitions pretty much all throughout our policy and make them as clear as we possibly can so that they're not only easy to understand but also legally sound and all those types of things.
And one point I'd like to add when you mentioned about the accreditation based on the information that I received and it was in the news that you received it from a company called Nigel. Nigel is from Utah, is a private company out of Utah. And they were the ones that they accredited the police department and they did that same thing with the sheriff's department, Boone County Sheriff's Department. And in their report there, I have a copy of their written report, that the audit was a self audit. It was a self audit done by internally, and it was endorsed by this private company. They charged $8,500 to accredit. The main issue is that a lot of this is a private company. There's nothing from our state, nothing from our county, nothing from our city, and it's from Utah. And this company, but it's just a company, it's a private company. And they have, their interest is primarily in their income. And some of the things that they've collected and they're suggesting to things that it may apply to some other areas that they don't have any issues, you know, and so forth there. And it does not necessarily reflect our living conditions in Columbia, Missouri. And in line with that, to follow what Brandon mentioned, which is a very valid point that the lady across from me mentioned, there is that, is it at all possible that a meeting could be set that that some of the issues that has been experienced in Columbia, Missouri by citizens, that there are, there's a list of them that can be suggested, recommended to police department to integrate those into the policy for betterment of the, to better protect and serve.
To integrate what into the policy?
The issues there that more adapted to, would be adapted to our living conditions at the city of Columbia, rather than something from Utah or somewhere else.
Yeah, no, I get that. Going back to our conversation about Lexapol, that was a big reason I think we stopped doing that because we do have a different culture here. We do have a different group of people here. We want to integrate things from our locality that only our citizens are aware of, like into our policy. We want to make it unique to us, right? We don't want just some cookie cutter policy that you can purchase off the internet, I think is the reason we were getting away from that. So I don't know if that answers your question at all, but.
Do you have a procedure in place there, like in this case would be CPRB, perhaps I have a few issues with that also, that relationship. But is there something in place that some verifiable issues or concerns or some corrections, corrective measures can be recommended or transferred or basically to CPD, so CPD can integrate those issues there with whatever authority, you know, whoever, city manager or chief or CPD chief or new chief or anyone like that one, that can, for a betterment of the policy.
And I think I get what you're saying. We talked a little bit about like the meetings that we had previously that I guess citizens would come and offer input. I was not the accreditation manager back then. That's going to be something that the chief of police will decide. I know our current interim chief is not making, to the best of my knowledge, making any sort of sweeping big changes at our department. It's kind of maintaining until we get the new person. And when they get on, I'm sure that they would entertain any and all ideas. That would be my impression.
I just as a citizen, 52-year citizen of this county, this city, I would like to, I strongly recommend for CPRB to consider such action, because there are a lot of issues, verifiably, that need corrections. And that would be something that I think for our new chief, as a matter of policy, that doesn't have to be dependent on a chief or somebody comes that doesn't like it or somebody else comes and likes it. As a matter of policy, I think it would be wise, it would be prudent to integrate those issues there in our CPD office.
Can you go over, like right now, what's the procedure for approving a new policy or changing? Who decides that? Is it one person? Is it a board? Is it?
So go back to the policy process. Like I said, if there's somebody that perceives that a policy is in need of change, they would submit their policy revisions through their chain of command. And I don't have the form. It's on our document system. But basically, they have to review the policy, say that they review that policy. And I think one of their tasks is also to ensure that it does have CALEA standards that it conforms to before they submit that to their chain of command. Once it goes through their chain, through their sergeant, through their lieutenant, through the appropriate bureau chief, it would then come to me for review to ensure that those things were met. Once that happens, it goes through city legal. We have a representative at our department, our diversity, equity, and inclusion officer, and then the chief of police, and then I also get to review it. Once it gets approved through our internal chain, it would go to the human resources director and then the city manager. They approve it, send it back to us, give us the,
because it goes to, I think what makes some people uncomfortable in that presentation is at no point does that process begin with citizen input. It begins with officer input up the chain of command. And so to address the question you were addressing, sir, maybe we should think very hard about how to funnel input from citizens to the department where it's heard. And I think that is one of the functions that we're trying to do on the review board. We're supposed to be making policy recommendations. So far, most of the policy recommendations we've been making in the last months that I've known about have been because we're auditing complaints. And we're seeing some behavior, and we're saying, well, you know, if we change this policy on handcuffing, let's say, we might be able to avoid that conflict. So that's been the thing. But I don't know that we've done a great job of hearing from citizens. Could you please discuss this policy and make a recommendation on it and, you know, help us speak as citizens to the police department? So I think it would be much welcome. And I think there has to be a way for citizen input to get in the chain. So.
I think, to your point, I think we started with these policies because we saw that these were ones that had complaints filed against them. But if citizens say, oh, yes, this policy, you need to look at this policy, then that could be maybe next on our list. So that input, I think, would help us on what to review or what we should be reviewing. from you guys versus what we're seeing.
So as far as specific pieces of this policy that we're looking at, one that jumped out at me, I wanted to make sure I got looked at, is on 300.2, the second paragraph, where it says the decision to use force requires careful attention to the facts and circumstances of each particular case, including the severity of the crime at issue. For me personally, I'm having a hard time wrapping my head around how the severity of the crime you committed would objectively, reasonably play into the amount of force used against you. And I say that very carefully because objectively reasonable is what all this is worked around, because that's the legal precedent, the surrounding use of force in Graham versus Connor. And I mean, I'm not a lawyer, clearly, but I don't think that Graham versus Connor gives cops leeway to consider the severity of a crime when using force. And I imagine the intention of that was probably to say, like, you know, consider that, you know, petty crimes probably shouldn't need to use force against them. But the flip side of that is that you then infer that more severe crimes are warranting force against you. But the rest of the policy clearly explains that use of force is based upon, you know, threats to the officer, threat to the public, not that seems to fly in the face of it to me.
I'm glad you brought that up, because as I was reading the policy and then looking at specifically this language that I'm going to quote is from the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department, but I noticed that, you know, we do have language about, you know, the level of force, but there isn't any language about proportionality or proportional force, because what the Las Vegas Police Department has, and I'm just going to, in brief, it's officers must use proportional force when responding to a situation. This means that the officer should use the least amount of force necessary to achieve a legitimate law enforcement objective. Officers shall only use the level of force that is reasonably necessary to achieve a legitimate law enforcement objective, considering relevant factors, so on and so forth. And we don't have that least amount of force necessary language. And I think that you know, a little might go a long way on that, because I agree with you, because the implication is on the flip side, if it's very serious, very severe offense, that, you know, you're well within your rights to go pretty hard in terms of the force that's applied. But I don't know that that's necessarily necessary if you can achieve it with very little force.
Right. You know. Even if the person murdered someone and they're cooperating with you, that doesn't give you a right to, like, shoot them when they're not shooting back at you, right? Is that kind of where you're trying to go with that?
Sorry. As a citizen, I take documents as this that come from legal department to essentially, how it matters to me as a citizen is that this is what the police department is going to refer back to cover their butts in the event of me having a problem with something they've done to me. And to me, having language like that, like the severity of the crime in there, is just laying the groundwork for an officer to make a defense that, like, well, I thought the crime he committed was really severe, so that's why I punched him in the face. He assaulted an officer, so I punched him in the face, sort of deal, where, like, that in my mind shouldn't play into it. And I honestly think that, like, in a court of law, it might not necessarily hold up that you said I used force because the crime committed met some ambiguous level of severity.
In court, though, they do consider your policies, and that's why it's important,
mm-hmm.
is that they look at the policy and the training that the officers the policies they follow and the training they receive when they determine whether or not the officer did what he expected he was able to do.
And that's kind of where I'm at when looking at the policy in its whole entirety. It almost seems as this is like there's some type of use of force continuum. You know, if I go out and I see that an individual may have a knife, okay, so I've tried to de-ask questions, I try to talk, so then do I go to this next step? And that's some of the, I was kind of concerned about the way how the policy was structured and the way it was kind of written. Is it, are you guys trying to do like a use of force continuum? I mean, it's just, to me, it's kind of vague. There's some stuff in here, it's just so vague and ambiguous that it's not clear
And I think maybe by definition, there should be what force is.
Right.
Because, I mean, I understand the levels of force. I mean, what
right.
we're talking about on the continuum. But just being a uniform presence is part of use of force.
Right. Right.
But it's not defined in here for a citizen to understand
right.
that just an officer's presence is part of that continuum.
Right.
So maybe if we had something
yeah.
in there to at
or
least define it.
I mean, I wouldn't mind seeing something like the resistor, something that defines like the resistor. Is it a passive resistor? Are you guys going to like a protest
okay.
and somebody is, you know, barging, you know, blockading the area and you say, hey, look, you need to get up or whatever, but they're still not resisting. I mean, they're not putting their hands up. They're not complying. So I think that I would like to see something like that into the policy as well, to those levels. You know, what's a person that's cooperative? What's a passive resistant? What's an active resistant? Because I think that would help their officers too as well, in which knowing how to kind of respond to this.
I see a question.
Yeah.
No, I was
going to
make a comment.
Oh.
So essentially, the my name is DeAndre Thompson. I'm the university officer in the city of Columbia. I've actually been doing some of the research that you all have been recommending, or at least talking about the force continuum. One of the things that I've noticed is that in our policy, there isn't a way to interpret clearly sometimes what that is ambiguity
yeah.
with what the language may state.
Mm-hmm.
So some of the municipalities or localities that I've researched, there are like visuals, and there are continuum representation that
right.
takes you step by step throughout that use of force policy. And I actually have an example here from Tacoma, Washington, that actually shows the breakdown within each of those levels. And I think that to your point, what it does is it gives clarity to what constitutes, what justifies
mm-hmm.
a particular level of engagement, even going down to the actual resistance and all of those different concepts. And I think that again can ensure that there is clarity from
mm-hmm.
both standpoints of the active person and the officer or a person who's responding. So there is research there and information there that could be useful,
mm-hmm.
that could help us as we develop all this type of strategy that you all may be able to find useful as well as you do your review. So that's something that, and I have been meeting with our diversity equity inclusion officer with the Columbia Police Department. It's something that we are actively working together on to ensure that as these processes begin, that there's clear understanding of how to develop that type of policy.
Okay.
That
would be great.
Thank you. Oh, yeah.
Throw in a note of warning when trying to define compliance, if that were to make it into this policy, because someone who's experiencing trauma, whether that's someone being in a mental health crisis or someone who was a witness to a shooting or someone who was shot or possibly even the shooter, they're going to have a different response than a lot of people. They're not in any state to understand compliance or to act what we would consider a normal compliant response. So just for the board and thinking ahead, we may need to consider people that are not able to comply as well.
Right.
Right. Well, and if a person isn't truly dangerous and they're not complying, sometimes time and distance helps with that a little bit. I think it's redefining what our expectations are.
I want to, since we're going a little specific on things, which I like, just going back to, or I guess we haven't moved 300.2, or rather I need us at 300.1, I guess. You know, it's a little thing, you know, purpose, you know, for a policy, but I did notice that, well, I guess actually, you know, this would belong to 3.2, my mistake, I'm so sorry. But, you know, a lot of police departments, you know, Philadelphia, Las Vegas, San Francisco, and then some that are closer to our size, they use language that is, you know, somewhat similar to ours, but different in the sense that, you know, it reads more so, I'll read ours and then I'll read, you know, kind of theirs. It is the policy of the Columbia Police Department to value and preserve all human life without prejudice. Officers shall only use force that is objectively reasonable to bring an incident under control or accomplish law enforcement objectives while protecting the safety of officers and others. Officers should apply de-escalation techniques when possible and shall use force only when no reasonably effective alternative appears to exist and shall use only the level of force which a reasonably prudent officer would use under the similar or same conditions. And a lot of other departments lead with something that is a little different, which, you know, there still is a conversation about, you know, officers hold the highest regard for dignity and the liberty of all persons without prejudice and place minimal reliance upon the use of force. That's a bit different. And place minimal reliance upon the use of force. But in addition to that, I think we use shall a little more than others do, because I believe in Philadelphia they say officers will apply de-escalation techniques when possible. The department respects the value of every human life, and the application of deadly force is a measure to be employed only in the most extreme of circumstances, and a lesser means of force have failed or could not be reasonably employed. And I think a statement like that would be a little better, you know, than maybe what we have now. At the very least, you know, minimal reliance upon the use of force and the use of force policy, I think, is good to include, because in an ideal world, I mean, you know, it is kind of implied that you should use de-escalation when possible, but I don't think that it is bad to state that as minimal as possible, and then going back to the proportional, the least amount of force necessary, because I don't know that necessarily what we want is for the police to be encouraged to use force. It's supposed to be,
right,
or at least in my mind, you know, I'm not a lawyer, I don't play one on television, I'm not a police officer either.
I don't play one.
But generally speaking, I don't know that we want too many use of force in.
Right. Right. And some of the policies that I had looked up when we, a long time ago when we had the meeting, also added wording to recognize that the use of force needs constant evaluation and that it is a serious responsibility. And I think it's very important to understand that if someone has a job where they can use force on other people, it's a huge responsibility, and that they understand that.
And you might be talking about this language because I've seen something similar. And
mm-hmm.
In a confrontation, an officer will continuously reassess their response and adjust
yes.
any use of force accordingly based upon the level of resistance encountered.
Right.
Failure to reassess each application of force can lead to a violation of law and or policy.
Yes, and that was in the PERF standards.
I think you could kind of succinctly describe the differences as, like, those policies you're using as examples feel more like aspirational, or like they're setting a goal for what use of force should or shouldn't look like, whereas ours honestly reads more like a legal defense, like, you know, like laying the groundwork for how can we fit officers' behaviors into this policy. And you're right that a lot of the specifics isn't that different once you break it down, but how you frame it makes a big difference in a document like this.
Right, yes.
Yeah.
And our expectations.
One real scenario I'd like to bring to the picture, and that is when someone is being warned by a police officer and then saying that, get on your knees. Police officer says, get on your knees. And if that person has got a problem with his knees, he cannot really physically get on, and I've seen some scenarios, the real incidents, he cannot get on his knees there. And that may be construed as resisting arrest, because all of these terminologies are all subjective, and the judgment for that is by officer. So if officer says, get on your knees there, and the guy's got a problem, and he says, well, I can't get on my knees there. So the officer can tackle that guy. Why are you resisting? This is a resisting arrest, and he's going to be charged. And that's where the excessive force can come into the picture, because, well, if you find out if the guy's got a problem, he's an elderly or he's got a problem with his knees. As simple as that. He cannot get on his knees there. So that means that you are not obeying the officer's order.
Right.
That becomes resisting arrest.
Right, and there was an instance of that, not locally, but where there was a gentleman driving his car and he could not walk. He was incapable of walking, and they told him to get out of his car. And he tried to explain to them that he could not walk. He had a car that he could drive with his hands. He couldn't use his legs. And they drug him out of the car and they beat him to a pulp. And so that's a similar instance, is that we don't want things like that happening in our city, where when a citizen tries to explain why they can't do what the officer says and they're not being combative, is that maybe it's time to listen just for a few minutes to what that person has to say.
So, but to go along with what you were talking, the previous, or the other police department, the continuum of, and to constantly reassess, let's go back to the instance in January that I mentioned earlier. We had the gentleman having a mental health break, and the police department decided to use beanbags at him. That didn't work, and they never retreated. They didn't fall back when he started coming forward. Yes, he had a knife, but he's having a mental health break. They're very well aware he's having a mental health break. They use it, since the beanbags didn't work, they have SWAT kill him. Now, what we have was, we didn't have them falling back. We did not have them using the BOLA wrap, which is where they shoot out and it's the little twirly things and it wraps the rope that wraps around their legs. That would have worked. We didn't have a lot more of the de-escalation, you know, like we didn't have the crisis negotiators that are very specifically trying to help with the, like the social worker type crisis negotiation people. So that continuum of support, it seems like that if we would have had a policy like the other police department, we could now have this gentleman. He probably still be in a mental health play or a mental health hospital, but he would still be alive. And there's a chance that he could become a more productive, valuable, well, he was valuable. All of us are valuable members of society, but he could have become a productive member of society back and not have missed out on that. And so I think that if we would adopt that, again, that we need to use the least amount of force possible, and we need to have this continuum, and we need all officers trained on non-lethal uses of force. For example, I come to find out that not all officers know about the BOLA wrap, which is kind of scary, because there's apparently 10 of them in the police department, but yet not everybody knows that they're there, and that should be a valuable remember part of being able to do.
Yeah, I don't think everyone's trained on that.
Mm-hmm. It stands out to me, actually stands out is the point. When I hear this discussion, it strikes me that we have a policy that headlines use of force and response to resistance, and we bury within that policy a section on de-escalation. Now, in fact, I hope and believe that most of the encounters that officers have with police don't lead to the use of force, that what they lead to is a conversation, a de-escalation, information being exchanged, and things like that. So I think it might be useful in terms of what's sort of salient to people. I mean, if our actual policy was about de-escalation and the use of force, so that we immediately declare that de-escalation needs to be in consideration actively. We don't start thinking use of force, but maybe I can de-escalate. But the first step is de-escalate, or am I going to have to use some force, if you see what I mean? So to highlight de-escalation instead of having it being a sub-part of the policy might not be a bad idea.
I think that's a good point. Because that's the goal.
Mm-hmm.
in all cases, is that it's a win-win for everyone.
Simplicity of saving lives.
Could,
everybody's.
Mm-hmm. Could I ask a question about, and this is, I guess, a bit, you know, off the beaten path a little bit, but it's still in police policy. 300.7, the duty to intervene.
Okay.
So, you know, there's some language in other departments about protection from, you know, some protection against retaliatory, you know, behavior from, you know, supervisors or other employees for, you know, intervening or, you know, making a report of some misconduct. And so I was wondering if, I know it's a long police policy handbook, but is there any language about retaliation? I cannot talk today.
Retaliation.
I'm educated, I promise. Retaliation. Is there any language about retaliation anywhere else in the handbook or in the policy book? Because I know it's not necessarily in 300.
Retaliation by other employees.
Yeah, for reporting misconduct or trying to break it up.
I believe, Julie, we
it's
have something.
It's in the
IA
policy.
Right? Yeah, mm-hmm. There's a policy. It's a complaint, a positive one. It has some language regarding retaliations and things like that.
Okay.
And then
1020.
Yeah. It may also be mentioned somewhere else. That's the only other one I'm aware of.
And what were the numbers you all just said?
1020.
While we're on this back,
I'm not running away.
Oh, hey, okay.
He's like, he doesn't come back. He goes, I'm at it.
We'll talk amongst ourselves.
While he goes there, this is Toni Messina. She's our community supervisor for the police department. And I thought maybe she could help you figure out how community meetings go.
Okay. Yeah, thank you. I think it kind of depends on what the aim of your community would be. And you certainly have the forum, as you're using tonight, to air issues, talk about policies, address other things that are concerning citizens. But would you want to throw out a theoretical type of meeting, and then we could see how it could possibly be set up as an example?
Well, so, you know, as we talk about this review process and whatever stage that it's in for in terms of updating these police policies, would kind of like to be a part of it in terms of, like, there would be a public comment period, like when the FDA releases something or, mm-hmm. you know, so whenever a full draft is made, since, you know, there is not currently a mechanism for the citizens to put input on the front end of that, if, you know, once there is a draft made of these new police policies, that there could be some public notice and then, you know, maybe meetings by, if not by ward, then, you know, in a central location like this, it had happened quarterly. And having not been to those old meetings myself, I couldn't say what the structure of those would look like, but I think they would have to follow after the police department has put together what their view of, you know, the policy should look like before they go to the city manager, before they, you know, once they're direct.
I can speak to that a little bit because I was involved in at least.
Great. I can't hear you.
I will try my best. I can address that a bit because pre-COVID, I was involved in one of those meetings and we had, I don't know, maybe 3, 4, 5 different policies that the department was considering revising at the time. We announced a meeting through the news media. We held it right there in the city council chamber. The accreditation manager was present, and I think we even had some virtual participation that night because COVID was starting to kind of gain steam. Individuals would come up to the podium and ask their questions, and a conversation would ensue between the person at the podium and the accreditation manager. And if it sounded like it might be an acceptable thing to take back to the department, then we would acknowledge that. I mean, at any rate, everything was considered in that forum and then taken back to the department where it went through the chain and up to the chief. accept or not, and then offer whatever the result was to the city manager and to HR. So I could conceive of something like that happening again. I think you would want to, I don't know if you would want to do that for every policy or for the ones that really concern the community the most, because you do want to get input that's helpful to you, and you do want to make the best use of people's times, and you do want to get the information you need to make decisions about your recommendations.
And you know, I think there could be a way to for us to communicate with you all what those policies would be through our, you know, function of the board, you know, through the public comment period that we have and find out.
And now you're reminding me of something that I meant to say. I don't recall if we posted those policy revisions online and said, you have a couple of weeks before the meeting is going to take place, look at these and bring your thoughts. Now we have Be Heard Columbia, and it's conceivable that we could put a policy out there and start collecting comments so that by the time a meeting took place, there would be a body of information that could be considered.
Comments, and then, you know, maybe also potentially a survey. Mm-hmm.
I think that would be a pretty good mechanism for providing notice and then getting feedback.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
I'd like to add one point to the point that you raised, 300.7, and that is that's everything is all considered as one-sided, meaning that for the police department. And speaking as a first-hand observer, is that the culture of law enforcement is that when an officer does something wrong or in excess, other officers, not only they do not correct that officer, they basically try to cover it up and try to support that, try to, many incidents there that I have personally experienced. And when you see in the news there, nationally, it is rare that something like that happens. And it's just accidentally one of the officers had his body cam on and he catches another officer doing something illegal or improper or what have you there. There's, again, nothing in there that has got the citizens' input in that, meaning that supposedly if an observer, let's just say, an observer or a person has been basically, you know, under suspicion or whatever, happens to be able to provide the proof of the impropriety, let's just call it that, there is no authority, none in the state of Missouri, and that comes from the experience, none in the state of Missouri that we can, a citizen, a regular citizen, can bring those issues that can be, not even CPRB in Columbia, but CPRB is in Columbia. But with all due respect, you do not have the authority to do that. You can make recommendations, you can just make a friendly thing, but you don't have an authority. That's one of the major areas that we are lacking in the state of Missouri. In the state of Missouri, we are lacking that. And that applies to our sheriff's department as well as our CPD. It really does. There's none, none. And that comes from the experience. None. It does not exist. I think that would be proper. It would be prudent to for our CPD, for our CPD, and for our CPRB to consider something like that. That because, again, for enhancement, for betterment of the policies, and for our community, for our citizens, to at least be receptive to hear some of the issues there, and you know, to the evidence. To back up that 300.7 from an informant, if you would, or from a third party that is not party to the law enforcement.
So there is before city council, and both of our city council members, for some reason, left. But there is before the city council right now a CPRB model change that was brought forth by the previous board and did have some resistance, mainly from the CPOA, the Police Officers Association. But there, so we need, and the model change was meant to give the CPRB that power to work as equal partners, not as to work as basically the lackey. And so we need community members to again start pushing, because Barbara Buffalo said that they would be looking at it, and she's the mayor, and that was what, 6 months ago, and we haven't heard a single word since. But she very specifically told the members of CPRB that they weren't even allowed to discuss it. And we need very much pushback, because we need them to be equal partners, not to have down here and just say, well, we think we should. It needs to be.
You will.
You will.
And that would change policies.
Yep.
Right on.
Because the problem is now you can make suggestions to policy changes and model changes, even to the police department. And with the model that you have, you don't have the authority to enforce any of it.
I think that is as good a time as any to take a 15-minute break. Before we do that, yeah.
Yes, I just have one question about Mexico. So just to clarify, the police department is no longer using like its services and its software, right?
Correct. Okay. As far as I know, if it's somewhere in the department, I don't know about it. Okay.
But the policies from Lexapol, it still makes up the policies used here.
Yeah, I can't give you a good answer on how many policies that Lexapol has some of its language in. I mean, I'm sure it probably touches all of them, most of them, because that's what we've used for a while. So.
It's 7:32, so, you know, we'll try to get back into this. We've had, you know, some changes in attendance, and that's okay. You know, it's a Thursday night, and people have a lot going on. I do kind of just want to touch on just a couple of more things that I had on my mind in relation to this police policy 300, and you know, I don't want to monopolize anything, because I'm sure others have thoughts, but there were a couple more sections. 300.10, which is the rendering medical aids.
Yes.
And so it, yeah, okay, so I'll go ahead and read it, because it's not especially long, but it says medical aid will be rendered as quickly as reasonably possible following any law enforcement action in which injuries have been sustained or reported by the subject. Additionally, any individual who has been exposed to chemical agents such as OC spray or tear gas, or who was rendered unconscious or exhibiting signs of physical distress after an encounter, shall be continuously monitored until the individual can be assessed by medical personnel. Medical assistance may consist of increased observation to detect changes in condition, flushing chemical agents from the eyes, or examination by fire personnel, paramedics, or hospital staff. And so, there was some language, once again, you know, I suppose I love Las Vegas, but Las Vegas has done, I think, a pretty good job of including a lot of the different standards that we've talked about tonight into their new police code. And so a part that they include that I think that would be useful in here, and it may present itself in the handcuffing policy, because as Sergeant Ray has told us, a lot of these parts are interweaving, and there's some redundancies, and I'm sure you're gonna be working to filter those out. But what they add is, officers will not restrain subjects who are in custody and under control in a manner that compromises their ability to breathe. Prone handcuffed subjects will be immediately placed in a recovery or seated position once safe to do so, i.e. the placement of a subject's body in a manner that does not restrict breathing or obstruct the airway, such as on their side or upright. And they include that in the rendering medical aid section, which I think is appropriate because I think in a lot of these situations, probably people are being detained when they do need medical aid, so they're probably in handcuffs too. So I just wanted to make note of that because I don't know exactly what we do in terms of if someone is on the ground, they're handcuffs, they're prone, you know, do we require officers to lift them up already, or are we, you know, do you happen to know? Yeah, I guess I'm just not sure what we do right now when, you know, you have a prone handcuffed subject who's like on the ground. You know, is there any protocol to try to get them up so that, you know, they're not just laying stomach flat on the ground or in a way that they're not going to be able to breathe correctly? You know, do we?
Yeah, I mean, when we go through the training academy and throughout training, that's kind of the goal, right? We don't want them to be in any position that is compromising for a period of time. We get them up into the same spot. So that is what our practice is.
And so it's not in any of the policies, though?
Honestly, if it's not in the particular policy about rendering medical aid, I mean, maybe somewhere else. But it is not in this particular one.
That's something, though, it really needs to be in there because, again, going back to what Renee had said earlier, that the police. Our police policies are reviewed by the courts whenever there's something that goes wrong. And so if it's not in there, you know, it really needs to be. I would also add that, again, we need to put in there, we really do need to remove shall as often as possible because shall is passive, whereas will is proactive, and we need to be as proactive as possible. There have been some examples even in CPD's past where medical aid was not rendered and things have gone wrong. And I would rather not have, there's been some national cases where things have gone wrong, and I would rather it not happen here in Columbia yet again.
There is one more point of emphasis that I want to make, and it was made a little earlier, just about.
I think he's pulling something
up. Oh, let me not step all over you. I'm sorry. Go ahead. Because that point can't wait. That is a
Remember, I told you there was the three policies, especially that are weaved together and all have different pieces.
Yeah.
And so you're going to find different chunks in all the different policies. And so. So scroll back up a little bit. Yeah. So while they're not exact, I think that's what you may be looking for in the policy manual. 306.4.4.
But it speaks in terms of things that could happen. And to just be mindful and watch for doesn't speak in terms of actively. You will make sure the person's in these positions. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
It's just being mindful. It's not you're responsible for making sure this person's not in this position, they're in this position.
And I think I would agree with that note. And so, you know, to go back to maybe a little more will and a little less shall. That touches on the idea broadly I was talking about, but it still would be better, at least in my view. And of course, I guess we'll have more conversation about this whenever we try to put together some recommendations for you all about my ideal would look closer to the language that I said as opposed to what the language
active voice.
So something else that I'm seeing in here is that when about the chemical agents and it. So I remember talking to a police officer years ago, and they had said something about there was an incident that was happening around and they'd said something about releasing pepper spray. And I'm like, well, there's kids around, so you can't. And they were like, well, yes, I can. And but they forget, or he wasn't trained or something, that children don't have the ability at a young age to switch from open mouth to nasal breathing. And so whenever their nasal passages go blocked up, they can actually choke. And, you know, like it can kill a child to have pepper spray released around them. And so I would like for something also to be in there about to keep mindful of when children, or at least I don't know how that could be put in there, but, you know, them forgetting that it seems like that, or like I have asthma and something else that's very similar to asthma that can actually cause me to quit breathing easily. And so they may not know that somebody like me is around, but if a child's around, that's a very blatant thing. They should not be using chemicals indoors when a child is in very near proximity.
And I, some departments, you know, I, of course, I haven't gone through the whole police manual, but some departments did have some language about being mindful of innocent bystanders and the deployment of chemical agents. And so I think that that's probably a relevant concern, whether or not there are children around or any innocent bystander. So.
Mm-hmm. Can I just let you know, in the definitions in the city code, shall is mandatory.
Shall right. is mandatory.
So that's
it's like the Ten Commandments, right? It's now shall not kill. It's not a recommendation. Shall is a strong word.
It's a mandatory requirement when it says shall.
Okay.
Yeah.
So would that need to be done by a policy for this? Because shall is like speaking from the point of view of a language major, shall is very passive. And like if you're writing like a college paper or something like that, you would not want to use shall. So it really is, since we are a very educated community, this is, sounds like something. So do we need to go before city council and have that policy change through that?
I will disagree with you about the meaning of the word shall. So, you know, we can worry about that all we want to. I don't think we need to make an issue of the meaning of the word shall at this point. We can look into it.
Sure.
Yeah.
Bill Clinton, depends on what your definition of word is.
Depends on, well, yeah. We're both teachers, I suppose. So, yeah.
Well, I think that shall, I mean, I kind of have an issue with the word shall, too. To me, shall is too arbitrary, it's too vague, it's too, you know, as the word, when you start getting to more specific languages such as will, that puts a little bit more emphasis, more mandate or something like that upon it. So that's kind of where, you know, shall is just, and I don't know, maybe you have to go to the council to get those things recommended. I don't know.
I think if we wanted to have a firm word, it would be must. I think shall is. I understand shall to be a stronger word than will. Actually,
yeah.
Will can be say. In general, people do such and such. People will generally do such and such. If they shall do something, it's a commandment. But if we have a disagreement about how people read that word, there are other ways to do it.
Yeah.
I think. So.
But regardless, that's something that
yeah.
I guess is a not statute but city code kind of.
It's in chapter one of the code and the definitions. So that's why in all these policies, if we want it to be mandatory, we use the word shall, not will or must, because the code defines shall as mandatory. And we want to make it clear that that is a mandatory requirement and not permissive.
Right.
Well,
interesting.
I just had one last point of emphasis I wanted to remake here, and I think this will almost certainly come up in our discussions when we talk about what we've gathered from here and what, at least my view on what I'd like to see differently about youth sports policy. And I did already bring this up, but the chokeholds specifically, you know, I just. You know, I do struggle to find a situation. You know, I understand when there's no other, there for whatever reason, there's no firearm available or there's no other deadly force is authorized and there's no tool that you can use to use deadly force, I understand that, you know, you have to use what is available to you, but I feel like a consensus has been reached in a lot of, well, I guess it's not a consensus if everybody doesn't agree, but a near consensus has been reached that chokeholds, especially because of recent events, you know, in America are something that we don't need to have in policing under any circumstance. Sleeper hold, lateral vascular neck restraint. And so I would probably, looking at 300.13.1, just strike through. Wait a minute. The language I have is
300.6 has got some stuff in it. Maybe that's what you were looking at.
One second. I'm sorry here. Okay, yeah. 300.13.1. Part C. I would probably strike through everything after prohibited. Just, you know, and that's, I'm sure, a controversial debate within CPD about if there is any circumstance where a chokehold is necessary versus where they should be banned completely. I'm of the opinion that they should be banned completely. But, you know, that's something that I guess we'll have to discuss more in terms of what we're looking for in terms of policy. But I did want to just reemphasize that point, because I, you know, if I hadn't seen police departments where it is banned completely, I would say that, you know, using that federal language of, you know, unless and except is fine, but to see that, you know, we do have peers of similar size and then the police departments of much greater capacity, you know, thousands of, you know, sworn officers, or, you know, hundreds of sworn officers, I think, that certainly we could at least have a conversation about banning chokeholds completely.
And it wouldn't, like you said, if chokeholds were to be banned, it wouldn't do anything with the accreditation that we have with, was it CALEA? Right? You just said that. Okay.
Outside of that, you know, that's really what I have brought so far in terms of looking at this policy, and, you know, others may have thoughts as well, but I just did want to make that point again about the chokeholds, because that is something that had been raised to me by, you know, people not at this meeting, but who knew that we were going to talk about use of force. Other thoughts?
I don't know if it's supposed to be under, would be under here if there's de-escalation. I don't remember if it's part of someplace else, but I would like for de-escalation training to be more than 1 hour per year mandatory. I think 1 hour every 3 months is more like what it should be. Especially since they do have, I think it's 10 hours that they can use as elective choices for training, something like that. There's a number of choices, and so it would not mean that you would have to up any training. It would just make sure that there is more training on de-escalation.
But is that negotiated in their contract through the union?
Some of that, correct me if I'm wrong, is some of that from the Department of Public Safety?
All of it.
Yeah, all of it.
So there's minimum mandatory guidelines, but I mean, obviously they can do more, which is what you're suggesting. Do more training than is, you know, per guideline.
I didn't know if that was negotiated.
Yeah, Post had just recently, like within the last couple of years, stated there had to be 2 hours of de-escalation and
implicit bias.
I'm sorry?
Implicit bias.
Yes, implicit bias training. And before, I think it was just 1 hour. But before that, Jeff had said, and Jeff has even said even more recently, that they were going beyond Post standards. But I think that he wasn't taking into consideration that Post had recently upped it to what CPD had. And so if we want to say that we are doing more than what Post requires, I think this would be a
good place to start.
I wouldn't mind seeing what that de-escalation training looks like, if possible.
I agree.
Do what? I'm sorry.
I'm saying, I mean, we keep using the word de-escalation, but
right.
I just don't think we're using the same.
Right. It should be actual de-escalation, not what their description of de-escalation is, right? Is that what you're saying?
He said he'd like to see the training, to see what it is involved in.
Yeah.
That's what he said, yeah.
Because, I mean, I might come away with something different.
Yeah, I'll be attending the training session that's upcoming, and so I should be able to give some report to the board about what I see.
Those will be in October.
There were several coming up, yeah.
Yeah.
And when I was looking at the PERF standards and some other things, it talked about that most de-escalation training is at least 8 hours for the first training and 4 hours every year after.
Did you repeat that?
It said most de-escalation training is at least 8 hours for the first training and 4 hours every year after. De-escalation has to be conceptualized and practiced. And that I think that's part of the key is that you, it's not something that once you've been through training, then you just can do it. You have to practice scenarios so that you run through them in order to get that response. It's got to be automatic back here because in the moment it's not that easy to just, you know, start performing what you've learned if it's only a couple hours later.
And it was a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
No refresher.
Yeah, because the training I had was 8 hours. I think we had to go every year. Now, we didn't do restrain our facility, but we still had to learn it. And so it was very important for us to go through that.
Additional thoughts? Comments? Well, I may make an executive decision here if you want to indulge me in that.
Okay.
Seeing as we have a hard stop at 9 and we would have an hour left or so, if there is further discussion on Police Policy 300, I figure we ought to do it now because I don't know that given the amount of time we spent on 300, we could do 447 at the time. Allotted to us remaining. So I don't want to, you know, do a speak now, forever hold your peace. However, hearing none.
Reese, what is your plan to, how are you going to submit everything to the police department?
So we're going to have this conversation in open session. I'm sure there's going to be some emailing that goes on, not so much so that it's a, you know, whole meeting, but we're going to have some discussions about, we've all been taking notes about what's been said here tonight, and, you know, of course, I've got my own notes, and I think others have their own notes, and we're going to try to come up with some policy recommendations, I think, next month, and then from there, we'll figure out how that needs to be delivered to the police department, but, We'll be coming up with those policy recommendations hopefully at the next meeting. But,
possibly training is also the way. Training and policy recommendations.
Yeah.
You usually send that in a letter format to the chief?
Chief and the city manager usually receives that. Sometimes, if they pass a motion, to also send a report to council or show to council.
I'm going to synthesize some of what I've heard with what, you know, I initially had as ideas, and I'm sure others are going to do the same, and might be a bit of emotion-o-rama, if you will, you know, but, you know, that's fine, and we'll have it out, talk about, you know, what works, what might not work, have some votes, and then that'll be what ends up being included in that. So, unless Rose tells me differently, but that is what my understanding is.
That sounds good.
Well, I, we're not operating under Robert's rules tonight.
The city doesn't
operate. The city doesn't, I don't know, I mean, that's, Rose, I promise you, that's the last time I'm gonna say Robert. I don't care if we get a Robert on the floor.
You go by Bob, right?
Say, do we operate by Bob's rules?
Trying to engage the public and not impose Robert's rules so strictly that there is not opportunity for the public to engage.
Well, I think we can consider ourselves engaged tonight, so I would move that we stand adjourned.
I agree.
Thank you. Thank you.
Does everyone get to vote?
I think we'll consider this by acclamation, unless there are any dissenting voices. Hearing none, we are adjourned.